Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Welcome to the Tattered Cover. The Hanging Tree is prominently displayed on the front of the August Indie Next list. For those of you who don't know, the books on this list have been voted on by independent booksellers who have read and liked the book. Harlan Coben calls Brian a major talent, and booksellers agree. Please join me in giving a warm Tattered Cover welcome to the author of The Hanging Tree, Brian Gruley.
Thanks for coming. I have two housekeeping details to tend to before I begin. First of all, my brother-in-law, Brian, who lives here, has awesome seats for the Georgia-Colorado game on Saturday night. They're $100. They're in some of the best seats in the stadium. If you're interested, he's right there. Thank you. And his wife, my sister, Kathleen, is dying to be in one of my books. So if you get a good look at her, if you can suggest the character, I'll take it. I always tell her, you don't want to be in one of my books. I was in a little town in Michigan, and some guy goes, hey, would you put East Jordan in your next book? I said, would you like it to be the home of the pedophile or the serial killer? Anyway, enough about me. I made a mistake on my first tour for Starvation Lake, which was a year and a half ago. I was in Okemos, Michigan, and that would be, this is Michigan. We're in Denver, and Okemos is about here. Here's Detroit. Up here is the general direction of Starvation Lake, where these books are set. And I was in Okemos, and I talked about me, and a little bit more about me, and more about me, and then some woman put her hand up and said, would you mind telling us what the book is about? And so, normally I wouldn't read, but I'm going to read just a very short passage, which will give you an idea of what the book is about. So, to set the scene, it's February. It's a Sunday night. It's very late. And we're up here in Michigan, so it's pretty cold. It's winter, and the police are called to a crime scene. They found her hanging in the shoe tree at the edge of town. Gracie McBride had started the shoe tree some 20 years before, when she was 16 years old and in love, or at least lust, with a boy from Sandy Cove, the next town over. His name was Ricky, and all I remember about him is that he played football, not hockey, and that he went through one hell of a pregnancy scare with Gracie. No one told him that, even if Gracie did have a baby in her belly, there was no way to be sure that it was his. When she finally let him know her period had come, 2 days after it actually arrived, Gracie liked to have fun with boys that way, Ricky was so relieved that he drank half a quart of Jack Daniels and went out in his father's enormous Chrysler something and backed it over every mailbox on Sunset Trail between Horvath Road and Walleye Lake. It actually wasn't that many mailboxes, but enough for Ricky to spend a weekend in jail. Gracie was so impressed that when he got out, she told him to bring his football cleats and drove him out to an old oak towering over Main Street, about a mile east of Starvation. There, in the summer midnight dark, she took off her clothes and then Ricky's, and after they had writhed in the tall grass at the base of the tree, she tied one lace of one of his cleats to one lace of one of her high-top sneakers. She had dyed it a bright pink so you could see it from afar, and threw the pair over her shoulder and clambered up into the tree. Ricky told her this was a stupid thing to do, especially naked, but Gracie giggled and kept climbing until she could find no more branches that would hold her 90 pounds. Then she reached over her head and looped the pink sneaker and black cleat over a bough. Gracie wasn't as good at climbing down, or at least she pretended not to be. Ricky put his pants on and tried to help her, but he was too heavy to climb as high as Gracie, and she insisted, giggling again, that she was too afraid to descend. He finally drove into town, while Gracie sat on a high branch in the dark, wearing nothing, until a fire truck came and plucked her from the tree like a pussycat. When one of the Pine County Sheriff's deputies asked her what the hell she was thinking, climbing 50 or 60 or 70 feet into a tree naked in the dark, she said, "I don't know, officer. Didn't you ever do anything for love?" Soon more shoes began to appear in the tree. At the high school, hanging shoes became a spring ritual for graduating seniors, which naturally prompted a brief, futile attempt by the police to stop it. But adults hung shoes in the tree, too, especially after a night at Enright's pub. Out-of-state tourists saw the tree and pulled over and hung their own shoes and flip-flops, their equivalent of writing in the guest book at a rental cottage. Sometimes when a romance soured, one of the two lovers would bother to shinny into the tree and slice a pair of shoes away. But mostly the shoes multiplied. And over the years, the oak took on the look of a matronly ghost dressed in a ragged nightgown. And somewhere in her highest branches dangled a single snow-covered football cleat tied to a high-top sneaker, faded to a dirty gray, the pink but a memory. And way below the sneaker now hung Gracie herself. So that's the beginning of the hanging tree. Gracie McBride, who's dead for the whole book, except for flashbacks. Risky to begin with a dead character. Gracie is the second cousin of the narrator of the book, Gus Carpenter. And Gus is the narrator of the first book, Starvation Lake. Gus was born and raised in Starvation. He left after college. As a journalist, he went and worked at a big newspaper in Detroit. He was a big star there. And then he committed an egregious breach of ethics and had to go back home to Starvation, tail between his legs, and start working for the little Pine County Pilot. Much more of that is recounted in the first book. Gracie's death for Gus is something that he's not really surprised by. Gracie grew up a year older than Gus in Starvation. Her own father was killed in Vietnam. He's mentioned briefly in the first book. Her mother wasn't a very good mother, Shirley McBride, and so Gracie kind of bounced between homes, between her mother's trailer in the woods and Gus's house, where Gus's mother, Bee, took a matriarchal liking to Gracie, her second niece or something like that. Gus didn't really like Gracie. Gracie didn't really like Gus. They didn't really get along. Anyway, Gracie left Starvation when she was 18 years old to take a scholarship at a college in Detroit and really was never heard from again. Until 18 years later, she returns to Starvation, an obviously wrecked woman from drink or drugs or men or whatever. And she ends up in this tree. To Gus, it's not much of a surprise. As he says, Gracie has been racing to the gates of hell for most of her life. Now she wound up there. Not much news in that. But his mother prevails upon him to find out what happened to his second cousin, as does his ex-girlfriend, Darlene. Darlene Esper is a deputy sheriff in the Pine County Sheriff's Department. When she was young and Gus was young, they were lovers. Gus went away. Darlene wasn't happy about that. They became estranged. She got married. He came back. And in the first book, there's some tension between the two that is at least temporarily resolved. I'm not spoiling very much here in the second book, in the opening scene. But Darlene is still married. And what Gus has to do is figure out what happened to Gracie. I mean, it's an apparent suicide, right? And we all know what apparent suicides are in books. Must be murder. So maybe it's murder, maybe it's suicide. It's 50-50. I mean, you can guess the ending. 50-50 call, right? Or maybe something else happened. Teenage vampires and UFOs, right at the end of the book. That's the heart of the story for Gus. There is a little bit of a subplot. As you know, if you've read the first book, or even if you haven't, Starvation Lake revolves around their hockey team, the River Rats. And it, you know, it's like anything with a small town in America, or even some big towns. It isn't that hockey itself is so important, it's that that's what they have. Just like Washburn, North Dakota has ethanol, or Hammond, Indiana, at many decades ago, had steel. It's something that unites the town. This gentleman here is wearing a Green Bay Packer cap, and football unites that town in ways that nothing else can. And in Starvation Lake, it's this team that almost won a state title in 1981. If it weren't for Gus, our narrator, who gave up a goal in overtime to lose to the hated and feared Pipefitters from Trenton, Michigan. I'll tell you a little story about writing this book. When I was on my first tour, well, I'll go back a little bit further. I sold Starvation Lake as part of a three-book contract in May of 2007. And Starvation Lake was published in March of 2009. Shortly before the launch of Starvation Lake, I turned in the second manuscript, my second book. It had no title, which is a bad sign, and I knew it wasn't very good. I had a friend, another novelist, who read the book, and he told me it's not very good. And on my way up to Okemos, the day the woman asked me what the heck the book's about, I called, or my editor called me, and she told me it's not very good. We had a lot of work to do, and I had about 4 weeks to do it. Well, that was hopeless. There's no way I was going to rescue this book. And in fact, that night in Okemos, I was at a gathering like this, and a friend of mine, not knowing what was going on with me, put up his hand and he said, "So, did it ever cross your mind that maybe you only have one book in you?" And I thought, yeah, about 5 minutes ago. Yeah. Luckily, I have a great agent, and even though I wanted an additional year to fix or rewrite this book, she got me 7 months. And I said, well, I wrote a really bad book in a year and a half. Imagine what I can do in just 7 months. But I'd learned something, I think, from the book that I eventually just threw away. I started over. The book that nobody's ever going to see, My Real Sophomore Slump, I don't even have a title for it, involved the one thing at the heart of it that I wanted to write about was a shoe tree, which you heard me describe in the small section I read. There is a shoe tree about here, not far from my dad's cottage on Big Twin Lake, which I've been going to since I was 13 years old. And about 2 miles north of US 131 in Kalkaska, Michigan, is a big oak tree loaded with hundreds of pairs of shoes, which I've been looking at for years. And many years ago, I even tried to write a story about it for the newspaper I work for, the Wall Street Journal. And I made all these calls, and I just could not get a bead on why these shoes were there or any sort of theme. And so I gave up, but it stuck in my head. So I wrote this really bad book with the shoe tree at the heart of it. And then I started over. So I had the 7 months, and it's April of 2009, and I'm losing sleep. And one night, 3 or 4 in the morning, like a gift from God, that line I read you came to me. They found her hanging in the shoe tree outside Starvation Lake. And I'm like, okay, chick hanging in a tree. I can go with that. But now, this is really when I corrected the mistakes I made in the throwaway book. The throwaway book had too much plot and not enough story. And to many people, those sound like the same things, but they're really not. Plot is like a scaffolding or an erector set. And story is what happens when you hang setting and character and all that other, you know, conflict and dialogue on it. And it comes from here, much less than here. It also didn't have much hockey in it, which was a mistake for the reasons I explained earlier, because this is the thing that knits these people together. Hanging Tree doesn't have a lot of on-ice hockey, but there's a whole subplot about a rich guy trying to build a rink for the town. And that brings that whole, you know, who are we and what are we going to be theme to the book. And so I started over at that very moment, laying in bed, thinking about this girl, woman, hanging in a tree. So what's her name? And I had experimented, I had a character in and out of the throwaway book named Gracie. So I love that name. So I said, she's going to be Gracie. But the most important thing was, how will she be related to Gus? Because he's the narrator. So whatever's in the book has to matter to him in some very direct way. So I made him, I said, what if she's the cousin? And then I remembered this guy, Eddie, who is his dad's cousin from the first book. He's in one paragraph in the first book. So I said, that'll be Eddie's daughter. And then, what else can I come up with while I'm lying there in the dark? She's going to be Darlene's best friend. Darlene being Gus's ex-lover that he's now having this semi-flirtation with, even though she's married. And lastly, for the hell of it, I threw in, she might as well be fooling around with Gus's best buddy, Soupy Campbell, who is the great, probably the greatest hockey player ever to play in Starvation Lake, but pissed it away on drugs and drinking and women, etc. And I started there. And I had a sort of vague idea of what the ending would be. But I didn't really know how I was going to get there, and I started writing. You know, if I get 500-600 words in every day before I go to work, that's a good day. And I turned the book in, or the manuscript in, on time on November 1st. My editor read it in one sitting. That's not a big deal. Editors do that. They have to do that. And she called me while I was sitting at a Blackhawks game in Chicago, where I live, where you can't even hear the person sitting next to you, let alone somebody on a telephone. So we ended up texting. And what I learned from Stacy, my editor, was that she liked the book, and we had to talk and do work on it, but she really liked it, and something near the end had made her cry. And I'm like, yes. At least there's some heart in this book. Or maybe I'm just a manipulative, schmaltzy guy. You know, I don't know. Anyway, she called me that Sunday, and we spent an hour and a half on the phone talking, not about lines or even the plot. She talked about characters. Three or four, I don't remember which, that particular discussion. She went through these characters and said, this character wouldn't do this, but I need to know more about why she or he did that. And I took notes, and it was great. I mean, when you're a writer, and I have a fellow writer here from the journal, Stephanie Simon, who's terrific, so she probably knows this. You know, you write something, and your editor or your friend or whoever you gave your stuff to says something about it, and it's not brilliant, then you go, wait, first it's recoil. At least that's immediate recoil. And then if you're smart, you stop, and you calm down, and you listen, and you realize that in the end, you have to make all the decisions. So they're helping you, and you have to decide where they're right and where they're wrong. And that's what Stacy was doing for me. So I printed out the manuscript, and I marked it up with a pencil. And I'm, like, tearing things out and moving them, and there's Post-its in there, and there's longhand pieces stuffed in, so the manuscript goes from being that big to about like that. And then I sit down and open it up with a laptop, and I put all those changes into the laptop. So that's another wave of changes, really, because I'm changing the changes. Then Stacy and I had another conversation. Then I did the same thing again. Then Stacy and I had one more conversation. Then I did the same thing again. And then she said, I'm happy. And they passed it to a copy editor. It was a freelancer. Her name is Amy Ryan. She's in Raleigh, North Carolina. And she's really good at at, you know, she's supposed to do grammar and spelling and punctuation and chronology, but she's really good at words, and she did my first book, so she knew the characters. And so she marks it up with a red pencil and sends it back to me, and then I have a green pencil, and we go back and forth again. And the thing was, when I wasn't happy. It was giving me fits, really. It bothered me all the time. I didn't have it right. I didn't really understand why. But with Amy, I probably made, on that pass, 300, 400, 500 changes, mostly little changes, in addition to 12, 13, 15 scenes that I rewrote or added and moved around. And I was happy at the end. I was happy with the book. And I don't think I understood then why I was happy. I think I understand now. Maybe a year from now I'll change my opinion. But the thing is, Gracie McBride is a very difficult person to like. She is truly a wrecked woman, wrecked person. And Gus's reluctance to pursue what happened to her was, you know, I felt the same reluctance, which is not good when you have to finish a book, to be reluctant. And I think it showed in those first many perorations of the book. But it's like all of us have people in our lives who are very difficult to like, but we love them anyway. And I had to come to that sort of peace so that Gus, the main character, who is not me, but I am giving him his voice, so that he could come to that. Because in the end, the book's not about Gracie. It's about Gus. He's the narrator. Much as The Great Gatsby is not really about Gatsby, it's about Nick Carraway and how he changes through his experience of this rich guy with ties to the mob in Chicago. And Gus has to go. That's his journey through family and friendship and against the backdrop of an apparent suicide and a possible murder. And so to have him come to terms with Gracie, I had to come to terms with her. I had to love her, and I really love her, even though she doesn't exist, and was dead when I met her. thanks. And I would like to say one thing, that stories like Tattered Cover are great for readers, for writers, because they care so much about readers and writers, because they actually look at books and try to tell people who come in the store, this is good, you ought to take a look at this. It's not just dialing up Amazon or the New York Times bestseller list. And thanks for doing that. Sure.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.